And I'm thinking, am I really gonna have enough space here for an up-rep case? So what I do in this type of cases, I take all my photographs, which include a portrait, retracted smile, left, right, occlusal maxillary, occlusal of the mandibulars. I take a digital scan with a bite. I send to my lab technician or ceramist, and he sends me back an STL file that I print those at my office, and I make a matrix. It takes up one day. In one day, I can do that. And I can bring the patient back the next day and do a mock-up over the teeth.
Welcome to Austin, Texas, and welcome to the Phil Klein Dental Podcast. Today's episode is one I think you're really going to enjoy, especially if you're a young dentist, an aspiring practice owner, or anyone interested in building a high-end cosmetic practice the right way. I'm joined by Dr. Luis Abrante, a 31-year-old dentist who's been in private practice for just over 3 years near Birmingham, Alabama. And he's already built a thriving fee-for-service practice focused on comprehensive high-end cosmetic dentistry. We'll talk about why he made the decision early on to pursue cosmetic dentistry and how he overcame one of the biggest challenges young dentists face, getting patients to say yes to comprehensive treatment plans when you don't have decades of experience behind your name. A big part of his success has come from his use of photography, not just before and after images, but interim photos that document every step of his cases. Those photos have helped build trust, strengthen the dentist-patient relationship, and dramatically improve case acceptance. Photography has also become a powerful teaching and self-evaluation tool for him. By reviewing his own images, Dr. Abrante is constantly refining his techniques and finding more efficient ways to deliver better results. We also dive into no-prep veneers, why proper case selection, treatment planning, and a strong understanding of occlusion and tooth alignment are absolutely critical for those procedures. You'll hear how he markets his practice, although he does not participate in any third-party dental insurance, and why he prefers indirect restorations over direct, his favorite materials, and why, despite having a chairside milling setup, he often chooses to send his digital impressions to the lab. And behind it all is an incredible personal story. Dr. Abrante came to the United States from Cuba at 18 years old, not knowing a word of English. Today, at just 31, he's built a successful, fulfilling career, and he's already planning his next phase, expanding from 4 operatories to 6 and bringing on an associate. This is an inspiring conversation about vision, discipline, and doing dentistry at a very high level. Before we bring in our guest, I do want to say that if you're enjoying these episodes and want to support the show, please follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You'll be the first to know about our new releases, and our entire production team will really appreciate it. Dr. Abrante, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me again.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you back, and we had a really good engagement on your last podcast episode, and because it was so good, we wanted to have you back and continue the conversation. So you've made a deliberate choice to focus your practice on high-end cosmetic dentistry early in your career. You're a young guy. What drew you to that path, and what did you do differently from day one to make it viable?
Definitely, Phil. Well, ever since I was in dental school, I always wanted to have an aesthetic practice. Aesthetics is something that I've been thinking of, I think, even before I started dental school. And the minute I graduated, I started putting all the efforts and all my thoughts into how can I be in this path? How can I go into a practice where I can do what I like? I mean, I like doing other stuff as well. I like doing root canals, I like doing implants. In fact, I do many of those. But the focus of my practice is mainly aesthetic work, veneers, smile designs, and full mouth reconstructions. And as soon as I graduated, I looked for a really good mentor that helped me during my first 2 years right after graduation. And I think that was one of the things that helped me out the most as soon as I graduated. And I didn't want to be, I guess, the Instagram doctor. I know in Instagram everything looks really good and all that. My goal was to actually do this transformation for people and actually change people's lives. And because it's nothing like you get a mouthful of old restorations, and all of a sudden you put veneers and And it's incredible the change you can, the impact you can have in people's lives.
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. Their confidence level, the way they interact with other people, their self-esteem. Everything. Yeah, it all is affected by your smile. So You're a pretty young guy, as I mentioned. So as a younger dentist, how do you establish credibility and authority with patients seeking premium cosmetic work, especially when competing with more established clinicians in your area?
Definitely. It is still a challenge. I'm not going to lie. I'm working on that every single day because it's only been about 3 years and change since I graduated. I graduated in 2022, and at least once or twice a week, we get a case of a smile design. And when you talk about that in Birmingham, Alabama, where I am located, it is hard. And I think a lot of that had to do with me taking a lot of photographs, not only of the before and after. Before and after looks great. But if you show people the steps and you show how much of the tooth you need to prepare, especially those no-prep veneers, I've done many of those no-prep veneers. And if you show people the steps and actually tell them, hey, we're not going to have to do this very aggressive crown and reduce the entire tooth and leave you all the way down into very skinny knob on the tooth. But these are actually the steps that we do to get you from point A to point B. I think that has been my biggest selling factor, I guess, for lack of a better word here. That has been the biggest selling factor there, showing people the steps, not only the before and after. Photography has been incredible. It is incredible how much photography has helped me.
You know, I've talked to a lot of dentists on the show and my colleagues, and they agree that photography is really invaluable to their practice. Some of these offices have photography rooms where they just bring the patient in there and they take pictures. What kind of equipment, what kind of a camera and auxiliary equipment are you currently using in your operatory?
I don't have very, very, very fancy equipment, but I do have a nice one. I have a Canon T8i. It's one of, I guess, medium range type of camera. And I have a 100 millimeter lens that I use pretty much for everything, unless if I take a portrait, I may change the lens. But my workhorse is a 100 millimeter lens with an aperture of the 2.8. And flash, I have the flashes, the Godox flashes, the M12 flashes, the twin. I like the twin flashes with the soft boxes, the fixed light soft boxes. And I can do everything with that.
So now, do you take these photos yourself or does your staff take them? We'll be right back to our guest in a second, but first, when it comes to chairside milling and same-day crowns and bridges, speed usually means compromise, but not anymore. Katana 1 Speed by Curare is a major breakthrough in zirconia CAD/CAM blocks. It allows sintering in as little as 9 minutes without sacrificing strength, fit, or aesthetics. That means faster turnaround, true same-day possibilities, and less downtime in your lab or practice. With the unparalleled flexural strength and aesthetics Katana is known for, you get predictable clinical outcomes and the ultimate in patient satisfaction. The bottom line is, efficiency matters, and stunning beauty is non-negotiable. And Katana 1 Speed delivers both. Join the growing number of dental offices and labs embracing faster workflows without compromise. Learn more about Katana 1 Speed at CurareDental.com.
I take most of the photos I take myself. I would say 90% of them I take myself. I do have another small camera that my assistant uses every now and then for like shade match, like a quick shade match picture, and I'm working with a patient. She has that camera that is preset and all that. But I think it will be very hard to train an assistant in all the little details of how I want the picture.
So when you're doing a case, isn't it kind of disruptive to workflow to reach for a camera? You've got your gloves on, your gloves are, you know, have been in the patient's mouth. You want to maintain infection control, and now you reach definitely for a camera. How do you manage that?
It's a question that always comes in conversations. I do two things. One of them is sometimes I double glove. If I'm going to use the camera real quick, I put another glove to just take the picture. Another thing that I do very often is I cover my entire camera in the blue paper, and we cover all the things that you touch and all that. But my assistant, when I'm working on those particular cases where I'm very busy, my assistant does take some pictures there. The pictures that I'm talking about more mainly are the before and afters and when the patient just comes for a follow-up. Pictures that are in the middle of procedures, if I want to take it myself, I would do that. But if most of the times, those pictures are definitely taken by my assistant.
Are those photos used, like you mentioned, to help with case acceptance? I'm talking about the ones, the interim photos, not the before and afters, but the ones that mm-hmm. you're taking during the procedure. Is that primarily to show the steps to the patient?
Show the steps.
And you're telling mm-hmm. me that those interim photos, the patients actually want to see the details of...
Definitely. I would never think they wanted to see the details, but they actually want to see the details. If you show them, it's incredible how engaged they get in the conversations. And then they start asking details about, but are you going to drill in between my teeth? Are you going to drill in the back of my tooth? Are you going to cut the length of my tooth? And they start asking questions that you maybe never thought they were going to ask. And once you start showing the steps, it's incredible how much that engages in the conversation and how much that engages the patients into the treatment.
So you think the additional engagement and actually showing them what you're doing builds trust and...
It definitely builds trust, especially for somebody like myself.
Right.
I'm very young here.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to somebody who's been doing this for 40 years, the name itself may sell the case. In my case, I have to show you, I have to tell you here. This is what I have done. These are the last 20 cases we've done, and these are the last 40 cases. Or do you want to see a diastema closure? This is what we do. And I have enough cases now that I pretty much have a case for everything, I guess, or at least for the majority of the things that we do. And documenting all those cases has been a tremendous help.
It's interesting to me because, you know, typically you would think the patient doesn't want to know the details at that level. Maybe it's the fact that you're looking at the patient as someone who is capable of understanding all of this. And in that way, you're building a relationship with that patient, where the patient's thinking, you know, this doctor really appreciates my intelligence. You know, he understands that I want to know what's going on with my own teeth. I just don't want to open my mouth and hope for the best. I think it's a great approach. Now, you also teach. So these photographs are good for educational purposes, right? To teach your colleagues.
Yes, sir. There's definitely some of those ready photographs that I take, I use on the for my lectures, and it helps with everything. It even helps me correcting my own mistakes, because you do something and then the patient leaves, you don't see that anymore, and then you don't have a chance to go back and look at that picture, enlarge the picture, and say, maybe if I had rounded this corner of the margin a little bit better, maybe if I had done so and so better. It's incredible how much I have learned from my own pictures.
So when you can, Dr. Abrante, you've talked about how you perform no prep veneers. Obviously, this is a conservative approach, which is great. But, you know, the argument is that if you don't prep the tooth to some extent, you're going to have over contouring once you put the restoration on. So with that in mind, how do you approach no prep veneers?
The no prep veneers, it is a tricky concept, because some people, when the patients hear no prep, and they think everything will be no prep. And for some reason, patients associate no prep with a reversible procedure. They hear no prep and say, oh, okay, so whenever I don't like it, I'll take it out and that's it. So it is a tricky concept to explain to the patients, for sure. And one of the first things that I say is none of these procedures are reversible. But most of the patients that come to me, they already made up their mind that they want to do something about their smile. So I really don't have to deal too much with explaining about the reversibility of the procedures. But the no prep concept, it is true. If you don't have the right case, I think the no prep is about the right case. You need to understand where that veneer will be. You have to understand occlusion. You have to understand alignment of the teeth. And when we say no prep, sometimes you do have to maybe round the corner of one incisal edge or round the distal angle of a tooth. But no prep is, I would say, maybe 10% of cases. Not every case will be a complete no prep. But I understand the concept is that everyone argues is two bodies cannot occupy the same space. And I understand that. If you do a very skinny feldspathic veneer, 0.2 microns. We're talking about microns. I'm talking about 0.2 millimeters, something very, 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 very skinny. And when you polish that margin very well at the gingival margin, those margins become undetectable to the explorer. If you do it right, those margins will become undetectable. And I have had great success there, no staining, no problems with those. And I've been doing those for about, maybe my first case was about 3 years ago. And I've been able to follow up with that case, and I haven't seen any problems with the no prep veneers. Now, the problem with the no prep veneer is you need to know how to treatment plan the case. You need to take the right course. You need to or have the right mentor to teach you about the no prep veneers, because it's not only about dentistry. It involves ortho, it involves perio. You need to have a good team around you that you can have the right foundation for the no prep.
Now, does ortho hurt the case acceptance when you start talking to the patient about straightening their teeth? I guess you're talking about using clear aligners, possibly.
Clear aligners.
Yeah, and what's the typical period of time they have to be in clear aligners before you get to the veneers?
It really varies. I do clear aligners myself. I'm an Invisalign certified as well. And many of these cases I do myself. And maybe I would say 6 months, 4 to 6 months is the minimum, and the maximum could be 1 to 2 years, right? But if 1 to 2 years is mainly, sometimes it's not the typical no prep. The typical no prep veneers is a 28, 30 year old female that comes into their practice almost perfectly aligned teeth, but she doesn't like the shade of her teeth. She just wants to have wider teeth and I guess a better smile. And we just enlarging maybe the vocal corridor to help with the negative spaces and the gap around the smile. And that's the typical no prep veneer. We don't typically see a 60-year-old female or male requesting no prep veneers. Those are mainly, we'll prep on those.
Maybe. And what's the workflow typically for a veneer where the teeth are in position, they're ready to be worked on to get these veneers? What's your digital workflow look like? We'll be right back with our guest, but first, I want to tell you about Voco's newest composite, Grandioso 4U. Top clinicians are calling it the most tooth-like universal composite ever made. Unlike traditional composites that force you to choose between either an anterior aesthetic composite, a stronger layering posterior composite, or a fast but aesthetic compromising bulk fill, Grandioso 4U does it all, simplifying your workflow while delivering superior results in a single material. It cures 4 millimeters in just 10 seconds, looks stunning with 5 cluster shades covering all 16 Vita shades, and handles like a dream with 50% less resin. It's a 91% filled nano hybrid, giving you tooth-like strength, ultra-low shrinkage, exceptional wear resistance, and an amalgam-like high radiopacity. So as they say, seeing is believing. So grab your free sample of Grandioso 4U today at voco.dental.
A lot of times I will request a walk-up if I'm second guessing, if I'm looking at the teeth and I'm thinking, am I really going to have enough space here for an no-prep case? So what I do in this type of cases, I take all my photographs, which include a portrait, retracted smile, left, right, occlusal maxillary, occlusal of the mandibulars. I take a digital scan with a bite. I send to my lab technician or ceramist, and he sends me back an STL file that I can print to my office. I have the spring rays that I print those at my office, and I make a matrix. It takes one day. In 1 day, I can do that. And I can bring the patient back the next day and do a mock-up over the teeth. It gives me a template. And it also gives me a chance to show the patient, here's how your teeth are going to look like.
What's the mock-up? What do you use for the mock-up material?
I use DMG, the Luxaflow.
Okay, so you use Luxaflow.
Luxatemp, yeah. Temporary material.
Yeah.
It's very popular, I guess. Everyone doing, most of the people doing aesthetic work have used at least Luxaflow at some point.
So, Dr. Abrante, when we talk about smile design, that could mean different things to different clinicians. Walk us through how you collaborate with patients during the smile design process to align their vision of what they expect their teeth to look like with what's biologically and functionally sound.
Definitely. And I'm glad you touched on that topic, because most of the times we hear this trend nowadays where smile design, 10 crowns on the top, 10 crowns on the bottom, cut, and pretty much before and after. Sometimes I look at them and I'm like, is it before, really before and after, or before and before? What do we do here with smile design? So when we talk about a smile design, the very first thing after I take all the series of photographs and I understand the patient's goals and concerns, once we establish that this is what we want to do, then we enter into the phase of, let's start designing your smile. And the very, very first thing that we do is establish the incisal edge position. Once we have established the incisal S position, and once we check for aesthetics, phonetics, the rest just comes on its own. And all of this goes back to the lectures of dentures. I don't know if you remember though, when we were doing dentures, what was the first thing that they made you do in dentures? Establish the incisal edge position, establish in the wax rim where you want the tip of the incisal to be. That follows the labial curvature that follows the vocal corridors. And once you get all those parameters established, you have verify the phonetics and all the sounds, the S, the F, and all those sounds, then you can do a mock-ups. Most of the times, because I've done so many smile designs now, that most of the mock-ups I'm doing at the same time in-house. I don't typically send them to my my ceramist, because I've become like in 30 minutes, I can do a 10 teeth mock-up. So while the patient's on the chair, sometimes even a hygiene appointment, I can do a quick mock-up and show them, here's just more or less how your teeth are going to look like. And I can tell you many times my patients say, all right, when can we start? And it's incredible. Most of these cases were already in my practice. I didn't even have to mark it.
So when you're talking about doing the mock-up, you're doing it manually in the mouth, but you could also take a scan, intraoral scan, and then have the software do the mock-up digitally and show it to the patient too, right?
You can do it as digitally as well. That's a different way of doing it as well. Mm-hmm. Another way of doing it is there's a lot of smile softwares now where you can take a picture and the software will design the 3D, your before and after, and you can show the patient in less than 30 seconds how they're going to look before and after. But for some reason, I have had better case acceptance when I do it in the mouth. I just get a little bit of Luxaflow, put it over the teeth, I shape those teeth, I establish incisal S position, and I do the rest of the teeth. I show them in a mirror, and it's incredible. It works very, very good.
Yeah, I mean, it's the real thing. You're doing the real thing.
Yes.
Do you have any experience with a facial scanner where you're actually taking a scan of the movements from one movement all the way to the extreme, and then the software builds in all the other movements, and then when you take it to the laboratory, they can actually, it's almost like an articulator facebow transfer, but it's done digitally. Are you using any of that?
I'm not using any of that just yet. I have seen it, and I've seen great success with that. I have some colleagues that are using it. I haven't dived into it just yet because I'm in so many things at the moment, in the practice, building this and that, I haven't had a chance to do anything fun extra out of the routine.
It sounds like everything you're doing is fun, because it sounds like you're loving. I mean, you're like, you have a dream situation because you have the skill set, you have the personality, you have the knowledge and the passion and the love for dentistry. I mean, you got a whole career ahead of you, and it's just only going to get more fun because you're doing what you love. And that's really an amazing thing. You know, we talked a lot of clinical stuff, and I want to get back to some clinical stuff. But before we do that, I want to ask you about your renovation. You did some cosmetic renovation, talk about cosmetics, to your actual facility.
Right.
Baseboard, painting, basic stuff. But you mentioned to me prior to the interview that this actually had a big impact on your practice. So tell us about the renovation, how your dad was involved, and also tell us what you're seeing as far as the perception on the patient side.
Yes, definitely. It actually made a great impact. The office wasn't bad. The office wasn't looking bad. My office was built in 2015, and I took over last year. So it's been about a year now. And the equipment is not very old. It's actually everything's relatively new. However, it had carpet in the hall. Carpet wasn't bad, but it had a carpet in the hall. And the painting was a little darkish. I don't know how to describe it. It wasn't very bright. Well, what we did is we took out the carpet. We did lighter floors. Incredible how light floors, I know they're harder to maintain, but they give this illusion that is bigger, cleaner, and a lot nicer. We changed those black baseboards, the rubber baseboards. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even like those. We changed those rubber baseboards, and we put the conventional house white baseboards, and it looks like a whole new place.
Isn't that amazing how some relatively minor renovations could give you a feeling of, it just lightens up the place, it makes it a happier place. And it's amazing how that perception is.
It is amazing. Like, I can tell you, every single patient that has come through since we did the renovation, man, everyone asked me, is the place bigger? What did you do? Everyone's asking me what I did. Everyone's asking me what did you do to this place? And it looks really, really,
what,
really
what
good.
What made you do that? Was it feedback you got from your patients, or was it your own feeling that it was time to do?
It was my own feeling. I didn't like the carpet for sure. Even though it wasn't in the operatories, I didn't like the carpet. I don't think they're hygienic in my personal opinion. But and it also gives an older type of feeling to the practice, and I wanted to have a more modern, like today's practice.
And your dad helped you with that, which is really nice.
Yes. He helped me with that. He actually, I would call, he was like the project manager of the process.
You were able to keep the practice going while you were doing these minor renovations?
Yeah, everything was done on the evenings and weekends. I'll tell you what, working while keeping the practice open was hard. It was hard because many Sundays we were wondering, are we going to be able to open this on Monday? And it was a little stressful at times, but we were able to keep the practice running. We were able to keep the patients, and we didn't reschedule anything. And everything came out to be very, very nice. I'm very happy with the renovations.
Do you see yourself growing out of your space the way your practice is growing? Because you are, for someone mm-hmm. who's, 31 years old, who's not been practicing that many years, you're really developing a big following in your area, and that's Alabama, right? You're working in...
That's right.
What part of Alabama?
It is... the city is called Mountain Brook, Alabama. But most people are familiar with Birmingham, which is literally one street that divides Mountain Brook and Birmingham. So for people who are not from the state, they typically say Birmingham. That way it's a little bit easier for them to orient themselves. But the actual city is called Mountain Brook.
And do you feel like you're growing out of that space? Or do you think you have a good runway of time where you're going to be where you are?
Well, Phil, I actually have had to request help from a colleague in multiple occasions. A dentist colleague. She has helped me in multiple occasions, and we are actually booked for hygiene for the next 3 months. Yes, we are booked for the next 3 months. And I have found myself last week doing an exam doing like a consult on the waiting area because we didn't have room.
How many operatories do you have now?
I only have four. I wish I had five or six. I think the ideal number for everyone starting out, I think, should be six.
You're the only dentist, or you have an associate?
I'm the only dentist, but I have had the request. It was on a Saturday, a couple Saturdays. We had to start opening Saturdays because I'm Monday through Thursday, and I didn't want to open Fridays because I have a 19-month-old that I don't want to miss too much from him. I want to be at home as much as possible.
Sure, but if I
open Fridays, I'll have enough patients for Fridays.
So you have four operatories, you said?
Yes, sir. Four operatories.
Right, and you wish you had six, but you're one dentist. So even if you were juggling two operatories and a hygienist had one or two, that's four. What do you need the other two for?
I could have six rooms, my ideal case scenario would be to bring an associate, have that associate working out of one or two rooms, maybe two rooms. I can work two rooms and I can have a two hygiene room.
Right. So do you plan on bringing an associate in?
I would love to, but I
a little
don't
early.
Have
it's
enough
a little early.
Space in my, yeah. in my place right now. I am looking to expand, but I didn't want to advertise it too much because it is in the process.
Right.
And I've actually looked at some places already. I've done some research and we will probably do some changes in the next year. So maybe the next time we talk, I'll have more information for you.
Wow, that's a fast growing situation over there, which is really amazing. And talking about growing your practice, I want to touch on marketing for a second.
Mm-hmm.
So marketing a high-end cosmetic practice is very different from marketing general dentistry, where you do everything. And I know you do a lot of different things, but you want to consider yourself a high-end cosmetic practice, and you also don't take insurance, right? You're not taking,
no.
You don't take third-party insurance.
When I took over the practice, there were about six, seven insurances. I can't remember at the moment right now. And one of the first things that I did was I started one by one dropping all those insurances.
Right.
And yes, I became fee for service.
So what strategies have been most effective for you in attracting the right patients and, just as importantly, filtering out the patients that are not a good fit for your practice?
Let me tell you one thing I did. The person that helped me out, my mentor, told me since the beginning. And is if you choose the right city, the rest comes along.
The rest takes care of itself.
Exactly. And Mountain Brook happens to be one of the nicer, I would say, for trying to find a better word for that. I guess where
upscale, more, upscale,
upscale, yes, mm-hmm. upscale suburbs of Birmingham. And in Montebrook, you can present virtually any treatment, and patients say yes. Most of the times, I just tell you, we can do a filling on this tooth, or we can do a ceramic inlay. And all of a sudden, I don't even have to explain myself, and they say, "Let me get the inlay." It's I think it's going to last longer.
What's your selling point there on the inlay?
There's a lot of things that I can present in between inlays and resins, and one of them is being the you eliminate the polymerization shrinkage. Research shows that indirect restorations last longer than direct restorations. It less sensitivity, better aesthetics, and it's just a better restoration. If I were to get a filling and it's a relatively a big filling, I probably would want to get an inlay on that filling.
So you have a lab that mills that and sends it to you. You don't do it chairside, do you?
I have a milling machine in-house.
Oh, you do?
I do have a milling machine
in-house. And so you do mill the smaller restorations, inlays and onlays? You do that?
Most of the smaller ones I do mill in-house, and we keep them in-house if I have time. Lately, I will tell you, in the past month, we haven't been able to do so much of that because we have been busy. And that's another reason why we like to expand. If I have an extra room, I could probably have the patient waiting while I'm doing something else. But at the moment, I have actually been doing them myself, but not on the same day treatment.
Yeah, now
I
for
do it after hours.
So the materials that you use, and there's so much to talk about here, we can't do it all in one episode, of course, but you've got so much going on over there, and you have a patient base that will basically listen to anything you suggest because they trust you. You know, you've proved yourself to be a high-end cosmetic dentist. Are you part of this incredibly fast-growing trend of zirconia when it comes to your materials that you're choosing for your indirect? Because zirconia has gone a long way. You know, originally it was like strength, 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 but the downside was it didn't have the translucency that obviously lithium disilicate has. Are you finding that the newer zirconia materials are actually becoming the way to go, where there's no compromise now? You get strength and aesthetics in one material?
I think so. We're getting there. I'm not sure whether or not we are there already, but in the next 5 years, we probably all are going to be there. Still, I do a mixture of lithium disilicate in zirconia. I do mill some zirconia as well, but I think I still rely a lot on lithium disilicate, but I agree with your statement. I think zirconia is actually the way to go. We're getting there. It's just the way to go, especially, you know, we can bond to zirconia. I bond zirconia all the time with really good success. If you pick the right materials and if you do it with the right process in the right steps, you can actually, I have actually done zirconia veneers with good success.
Right. And zirconia now, the newer ones, are allowing for, if you have a oven that, a speed furnace, I should say, mm-hmm. that could accommodate it, you can cut your sintering time down with zirconia in half. They have, and I know if you're doing that with the lab, it's not that critical, but if you're doing same day dentistry where you have you're doing your own sintering, they got it down to 9 minutes on zirconia. You can actually mill, sinter, polish, and
stain
and sandblast in 25 minutes, the whole thing.
You can do the whole thing in 25. Yeah. You could probably do in 1 hour if you're fast enough. An hour and 15 minutes, you can do in and out.
Yes, in and out. If you have the right furnace and you have the right milling machine, I guess you need all that stuff to go with it. But the whole concept of same-day delivery, that was a big selling point by, obviously, Dentsply, which was Cerec. There's still a reason to have that. But generally speaking, what I'm hearing from other doctors that I interview, they're just sending it to the lab now. Like you said, you don't even have time to do the milling in your own office, which means you want to do what you do best and move on to the next patient. And then meanwhile, the patient will come back and you'll deliver what the laboratory fabricates. Does that sound like what you're doing?
I do agree with that. And I actually think it's better if you send it to the lab. The only advantage would be not having a temporary for a week on the patient. Is the only advantage I see on doing it the same day. But I agree with that. I agree that if you do what you know how to do and you send it to the lab, and I think that's just fine. The only reason why I got into the milling machine is because when I purchased the practice, I was like, well, let me try all these new things. Let me try that. Let me try this. But if I go back and analyze everything again, I probably wouldn't have purchased the milling machine. I probably would have I think I can do just fine without a mini machine.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of dentists are finding. It was a really exciting concept, and it's certainly taken off. I mean, there are a lot of dentists that have chairside milling. They advertise it. You get your crown the same day. But in reality, when you look at the practicality behind it in the real world, a dentist wants to do dentistry. They don't want to do lab work. And
I agree with that.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. we're getting to the point where 3D printers are now going to be able to kick out some really strong restorations down the road. They're already doing this in Europe. They're printing zirconia. I don't know how good it is in Europe, but they're doing it. There's going to come a time where you're going to be able to print these crowns right in your office, and they're going to be amazingly strong and consistent as far as fit.
Definitely. Yeah. I can't wait for that time. 3D printing, I think, is going to be a lot better than milling for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you're 31.
We're not there yet. Yeah.
You're 31 now. By the time you're in the middle of your career, it's going to be completely different with what you're doing now. That's how fast things are moving. And by the time you're at the end of your career, God knows what dentistry is going to be like. I mean, it's going to be, AI is going to have such a big impact in it. It's going to be pretty remarkable. But listen, there's a lot more we can talk about, Dr. Abrante, and it's really exciting to hear what you've done since the last time we talked. We'll have you on again, and thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really enjoyed the conversation.